The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back. Friday, January 17th, 2020. Okay, first off, an apology. I received an email yesterday. I'll read it in full, verbatim. Quote, Dear Professor, today on your radio program, this was last night, today on your radio program, I heard you publicly deride Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi for allegedly failing to understand the meaning of temporal, snorting something like she doesn't even know what temporal means. You mentioned it does not mean time, but rather worldly, not spiritual, as if it cannot mean more than one thing. So I went to the evidence, the dictionary. I don't mean to school you on the English language, Professor, so perhaps Merriam-Webster can do it for me, close quote. He then pasted the link to Merriam-Webster, which I'll point out he misspelled, since we seem to be about snark for some reason. I really don't think I've ever snorted anything on the air as he said I did. I'm also not sure I derided, but in any event, here's Merriam-Webster on temporal. Quote, 1a, of or relating to a time as opposed to eternity. B, of or relating to earthly life. C, lay or secular, rather than clerical or sacred, as in civil lords temporal. 2, of or relating to grammatical tense or a distinction. 3, of or relating to time as distinguished from space. Close quote. These are the definitions I always thought temporal meant, having to do with earthly, so to speak, rather than eternal or ethereal or spiritual things. That's definition one. Definition two is about that, too, secular versus sacred. Finally, time as opposed to the infinite or space. Now, here's what Nancy Pelosi said when I quoted her and criticized her, and we played the audio. And keep in mind, this was the least part of my criticism of her. It was a passing thing that I said she misused temporal, but here's what she said opening her press conference on Wednesday announcing the impeachment managers. Quote, I'll quote verbatim as well. Quote, good morning, everyone. This is a very important day for us, and as you know, one reference temporal markers that our founders and our poets and others have used over time to places in time to emphasize the importance of time because everything is about time, how we use it, how we mark it, close quote. I said she was blathering. She went on to make a bunch of disconnected references to time markers, but by any definition, she certainly was blathering and not using the word temporal the way she thought she was. What's the line from The Princess Bride? I don't think that word means what you think it means. Anyway, my only point was that she was blathering. She was bootstrapping. She was trying to summon up some grand series of moments from the Gettysburg Address to the Declaration of Independence and reverse to other things to affix this event to such importance as those things. Nonsense. To the degree you want me to apologize, sir, fine, here's the apology. I apologize for being correct in a way that offended you. Now, will you ask Nancy Pelosi to apologize for her complete and total discombobulation of the language and abuse of her position, if not also the English language? Or to me for being so darn sarcastic? For what it's worth, I've never called myself a professor. So, yeah, I take it as sarcastic that this email came this way. Why am I spending time on this, opening my monologue? Because you asked me if I would do a correction, for one. Second, because it goes to something we spoke about on the show yesterday. The left cannot do reasonable argument. They cannot stay in one lane of an argument. They have to drive all over the place, cross all kinds of lines, and do it mostly with unnecessary and unbecoming emotion. When they can't argue, they vilify. So not only will I apologize, I'll thank this emailer for giving me a quod erat demonstratum. Moving on, if I may. I was thinking back on the week and the luxury of our situation here as Americans in 2020. Do you recall what the big story was on Monday? Harry and Meghan. Now, totally off the radar screen. You know what else is off the radar screen? Let me read some headlines from the New York Times from the past 2 weeks. Quoting, for Trump, a risky decision on Soleimani is one other presidents have avoided. As tensions with Iran escalate, Trump opted for most extreme measure. an era of perpetual conflict, a volatile president grabs expanded powers to make war. Iranians close ranks behind leaders after U.S. kills popular general. The consequences of America's targeted killing of a senior Iranian commander are mounting. Volatile president, Iranians close rank, popular general, Trump grabs power to make war. None of it turned out to be true. Sometimes it might be worth pausing, news media, to think how much more accurate your news stories would be if they'd start with the notion of taking America's side. The normal side. The side that thinks removing a terrorist from the face of the earth is actually a good thing. You know, the way we pretty much thought under almost every other president until now. Because after a few things settled, what we learned was Iranians would soon take to the streets to protest their government, to call out the iniquity of the Ayatollah and his malocracy. And my favorite, hardly reported much anywhere, this week France, Germany, and Great Britain condemning Iran for violating the nuclear deal, and they triggering a dispute mechanism against Iran that could go to the UN with Iran as the defendant, the guilty party. In other words, France, Germany, and the UK not blaming the US, but blaming Iran for violating terms of its nuclear deal. In other words, Iran, 2 weeks after the Cassandra-like worry about the U.S. triggering World War III, is isolated even further in the eyes of our allies and in the voices and marching of Iranian citizens. The great lie, as it were, was exposed in this tyranny. Anybody here celebrating that, or do we just pick up and move on to the next lily pad, having slimed the United States and the president? That lily pad is impeachment, I guess. Now we hear about a witness named Lev Parnas, some third-rate Ukrainian huckster who says he has the goods, and the Democrats say he has the goods on Donald Trump. But what he says has already been alleged over and over and over again by other witnesses. Peggy Noonan, no Trump fan, has it just about right today. She writes, quote, "Putative administration operative Lev Parnas said on the Rachel Maddow show Wednesday that the president knew everything about efforts to lean on Ukraine. But this was clear in testimony throughout the impeachment hearings. His own ambassador to the European Union said it. The ambassador to Ukraine knew she was being schemed against, lost her job because of it, and spelled it out under oath. It's icing on a cake that's already sagging." That's great, isn't it? The president will be acquitted for a host of reasons, from partisanship to a prudential judgment that his actions don't warrant removal, with a presidential election 10 months away. Miss Noonan went on to write something else I thought right. Quote, "Meantime, impeachment as a dramatic and distinct event lost all momentum. In the month after the House vote, the story lost lift, then got lost in the Iran drama. The second stage feels not like the continuation of the first, but a brand new second impeachment, which a lot of people will experience as overkill. On the creepiness of the signing ceremony for the impeachment articles, modern presidents have always held such ceremonies and signed big, happy legislation with many pens. Lyndon B. Johnson liked clutching bunches of them in his thick, meaty fist and handing them out personally. But the impeachment of a president is a grave and unhappy event. It's not celebratory. Enacting triumphalism was shallow and looked like a tell. Why pens? Why not a scalp? Serious people understand the implication of things. Impeachment has now been normalized. It won't be a once-in-a-generation act, but an every-administration act. Democrats will regret it when Republicans are handing out the pens. Meanwhile, in full-employment America, Donald Trump is taking out terrorists with drones and announcing trade deals with China and seemingly weathering every storm. In the China ceremony Tuesday in the East Room, after a booming hail to the chief with a palpable sense of triumph filling the room, the golden frames of the great portraits shining, Mr. Trump rolled off the names of the CEOs in the audience, and there were a lot. There sure were. And Henry Kissinger. But you wouldn't know it from reading the New York Times or watching CNN. There's still an interest in the impeachment, and what I must say is it just got fun for me. For now, the president has Ken Starr and Alan Dershowitz on his team, and they'll face down Adam Schiff and Jerry Nadler. Reminded me of the scene in The Avengers when Loki asks Tony Stark, "What have I to fear?" And Tony says, "The Avengers. It's what we call ourselves. Sort of like a team. Earth's mightiest heroes type of thing." Tony goes on, "But let's do a head count here. speaking to Loki, your brother, the demigod, a super soldier, a living legend, who kind of lives up to the legend, think Pelosi, a man with breathtaking anger management issues, think Nadler, a couple of master assassins, think Schiff, and you, big fella, think the Democrats generally. You've managed to anger off every single one of them, think the American people. Loki says, that was the plan. Think Pelosi's plan to impeach over Ukraine nonsense and holding of the articles for a few weeks. Tony says, not a great plan. Loki then says, we have an army. Tony then says, we have a Hulk. Just so. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show, 602-508-0960. Your show this Friday, happy Friday, and fun Friday. I mentioned the Avengers in my monologue. I'm looking for another good movie to watch. I saw that when it came out. Been watching some old Clint Eastwoods lately, but if anyone has a recommendation, I am open to them. I have got still a list to get through, but always happy to add to that list. Monday, we'll do a show emphasizing the day that we will be having a national holiday on, the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. And I'll say a few things about Martin Luther King today, too. We'll hear a little bit about him this weekend. Probably not enough and probably not the right things. I'll get to that all in some. Do you have that audio from the Avengers? It is kind of fun, isn't it? Robert Downey Jr., one of the great comebacks in acting history, and one of the great comebacks in rehab too. All credit to him for how he's handled his fall and resurrection. Every saint has a past, every sinner has a future, right? Let's play that just for fun.
The Chitauri are coming. Nothing will change that. What have I to fear?
The Avengers. That's what we call ourselves. Sort of like a team. Earth's mightiest heroes type thing.
Yes. I've met them.
Yeah. Takes us a while to get any traction, I'll give you that one. But let's do a head count here. Your brother, the demigod. A super soldier, a living legend who kind of lives up to the legend. A man with breathtaking anger management issues. A couple of master assassins. And you, big fella. You've managed to piss off every single one of them.
That was the plan.
Not a great plan. When they come, and they will, they'll come for you.
I have an army.
We have a Hulk.
Yeah, I love that. Well, we have a Hulk now, too. We've got Ken Starr and Alan Dershowitz. That's great. Fantastic. That'll be fun. More of them, the better. I said a few things about Alan earlier in the week. I think it was Tuesday. And His legal bona fides. I know a lot of people think of him as political, but man, he really is a legal scholar, nonpareil, going back to the 1960s, youngest ever fully tenured law professor at Harvard, wrote the first textbook in the 60s. I looked it up. I thought it was the 70s. No, it was earlier than that. Wrote the first legal textbook on law and psychiatry. It was in the 60s. Long and distinguished career. Very able, very capable. One of the most quick men on his feet. Can't always agree with him, but boy, if you are in legal trouble, certainly someone you would want on your side. We interviewed him about a year or so ago, and I thought it would be fun to replay some of it. I'll tell you why. I was trying to recall. I interview Alan from time to time. We've known each other over the years, and I was trying to remember why I interviewed him, what the issue was. It was 2018, and was about impeachment. Funny thing that the president gets impeached on December 18th, 2019, because we mark time. Time is important. Time is time. Marking time is important. We time things. December 18th, we impeached the president, but that was 2019. Alan Dershowitz was already responding to a series of requests and moves and efforts for impeachment back in 2018. You want to play some of the interview? Play a little bit of it. It is a delight and an honor, a privilege to welcome back to the show someone whose career I have been following, whose work I've been following for, I just did the math, literally 35 years. Professor Alan Dershowitz, author most recently of the book, The Case Against Impeaching Trump. Few people need the introduction, Alan, as a guest that you would need, and it would take up the whole segment anyway, so I'll just say welcome back and thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks. It's a pleasure. I remember when we worked together in the past, looking forward to being questioned by you.
Oh, thank you, sir. Thank you. I read your new book, The Case Against Impeaching Trump, and I got to ask you, I don't know if you've had this question asked about it before, but the dedication. This book is respectfully dedicated to an endangered species, genuine civil libertarians who pass the shoe on the other foot test, because I think if I understand the dedication correctly, a lot of that comes to bear on what we're watching with the Brett Kavanaugh nomination as well. But I wondered if you might say a word about the shoe on the other foot test.
Sure. I think so few people in American politics, the American media, pass that. Take the Kavanaugh test case. If Bill Clinton had appointed a libertine to the Supreme Court, somebody who maybe had, you know, sexual indiscretions, every liberal Democrat, women and men, would be supporting him, saying, oh, kids will be kids, boys will be boys, let's not hold it against him. He was 15, he was 17. The Republicans would be up in arms.
Yes.
Oh, my God, how can anybody have done that? Now that the shoe's on the other foot, everybody just shifts sides. And that happens in every aspect of American life. I'm thinking of naming my next book, you know, The Shoe on the Other Foot Test, because it's become so pronounced today in American politics. Everybody is so damned partisan and hypocritical.
Yes, and it seems that in the partisanship and the quest for what I think is, I would say, is raw, a raw quest for political power, they're willing to do almost anything, including dispensing with traditional norms of your expertise, civil liberties, but traditional norms really of due process.
Oh, there's no question. You look at the ACLU. The ACLU has become a defender of repressive measures, and as long as it serves the ultimate interests of their partisan concerns. When the prosecutors went in and raided the office of a lawyer, Cohen, and got material that was covered by lawyer-client privilege, the ACLU was out there defending the search. Can you imagine if the shoe were on the other foot?
Yes, the ACLU is now on the side of the U.S. district attorneys. What a turn of events.
Yeah. Well, no, that happened particularly when the ACLU got into identity politics, when they decided that their board had to reflect the demographics of the country, or at least the demographics of liberals, and rather than the demographics of civil libertarians. And so you got people put on the board of the ACLU who were there because they were women, there because they were gay, there because they were Muslim Americans. When I was on the board of the ACLU, you were there because you were a civil libertarian.
That's right.
And you cared deeply about civil liberties. So today, identity politics has taken over the national board of the ACLU. And the question is my grandmother's question. You know, when I come back from a Brooklyn Dodger game, I say, my grandmother, the Brooklyn Dodgers won. She'd say, yeah, but was it good or bad for the Jews?
Yeah, right.
That was her only question.
Right.
And today at the ACLU, is it good or bad for women? Is it good
Hold
or bad for gays?
Right,
is it good
there. We'll come back with more of my interview with Alan Dershowitz on impeachment. Amazing how trenchant it is. I'm Seth Leibson, 602-5080-960. Open line Friday. Anything on your mind? We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show, 602-508-0960. Should we finish our discussion with Alan Dershowitz on his impeachment? We'll pick up where we left off. Go ahead, Bill.
That was her only question.
Right.
And today at the ACLU, is it good or bad for women? Is it good or bad for gays? Is it good or bad for Muslims? Is it good or bad for Democrats? Is it good or bad? You know, it's not about civil liberties anymore. Civil liberties, is it good or bad for the Constitution?
But
and
that's,
we're not
that's
hearing
a,
that.
That's an interesting segue, because it was another book of yours that I had in mind, too, given the contretemps we're watching unfold here. And it was a book you wrote. It's not exactly opposite, but it's close. The Abuse Excuse. The Abuse Excuse book you wrote. Who is the ultimate winner here? If they win,
if they win by their terms, which is to say they defeat Brett Kavanaugh in his hearings based on the inversion of civil liberties we have watched take place before. What is the real victory here? You asked that question in the abuse excuse. I think it's worth asking now.
It is. You know, people say I've changed. I haven't changed at all. Many radical leftists was furious at me for writing the abuse excuse.
Yeah.
Because I thought that abuse was being used as an excuse, particularly by people on the left. I haven't changed. I've been a solid civil libertarian, a neutral civil libertarian from the beginning. I vote my way. I'm going to always vote as a liberal Democrat. But my voting has nothing to do with my concern for civil liberties. And I think this idea of deciding truth and deciding civil liberties based on whether you're a Republican, a Democrat, a man or a woman, a Muslim or a Christian, a Jew or a Gentile, it just destroys any concepts of neutral civil liberties.
Let me ask you a question. I honestly have no idea where you'll come out on this, but the latest in the Kavanaugh hearings has been that the Senate Judiciary Committee, the majority, the Republicans, are looking to have an actual attorney do the questioning, an outside counsel come and do the questioning. Does this pick your brain or break your leg or pick your brain, in the words of Thomas Jefferson? Is this a big deal?
Yeah, it is, and it's a great idea. So I'm on the side of the Republicans on this one, but I'm completely on the side of the Democrats on whether there should be an FBI investigation. I think the FBI investigation should have continued. I think it should continue now. And I think every single person who has any information should be questioned. And it's a crime, of course, to lie to the FBI. So I'm not making partisan decisions.
Sure.
I do think that lawyers, particularly a woman lawyer who has experience in prosecuting or defending sex cases, is more likely to get to the truth, is more likely to have probing questions than some amateur senator who's never been in a courtroom in their lives. And so I think that's a good thing, but I think it's also a good thing for the FBI to continue its investigation. I don't think it should be rushed. I don't think there should be a vote necessarily in the next days or even next week. I think we have to get all the facts. This is a lifetime appointment, and we should take whatever time is necessary to get all the facts and all the information. In the end, it will be inconclusive. In the end, I think people will say, you know, there's smoke, maybe there's some fire, but it was a long time ago. He's led an exemplary life. He has a wonderful family. He's unlikely ever to do anything like this if he ever did it in the past. So now we have to decide how much weight to give to the past, how much to the future, especially when the past is somewhat uncertain. That's the situation people are going to confront. If they're honest, they will say it's a difficult question. If they're dishonest, the way the vast, vast, vast majority of American partisans are when it comes to issues like this, they'll unconsciously or consciously twist the facts and the evidence in favor of their pre-existing partisan gender or identity politics views.
There is a lot of that. There's probably way too much of that. Let me ask you about the FBI investigation for a second.
We can kill it there. That's fine, Bill. I just wanted to get a sense of the fact that he was already talking about pushing back against impeachment in 2018 during the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. How long ago does that seem? Oh, my goodness gracious. Seems like a long time ago. But anyway, I'm glad we've moved on. I hope that it isn't so long ago that the Republicans can't still remind the rest of the country what the Democrats will do for raw power, for a raw win, that they will destroy people like Brett Kavanaugh. They'll use any means necessary, whether it was Christine Blasey Ford, or whether they will use any. Look at the parade of people the Democrats have thrown up to try and take down Donald Trump, only for themselves to be taken down. Michael Avenatti, behind bars now. You know, remember, he was even going to run for president. He was such a hero of CNN, my gosh. I'm blanking on his name, but Donald Trump's old personal attorney, who's also now behind bars. He was going to take down Donald Trump. Again, he's the one bar. Robert Mueller, well, he's not behind bars, but he's lost his reputation, hasn't he? And now, who? Lev Parnas? Good God. I'm Seth. We'll be right back. Love Dolly Parton. Great. Nice addition. Thank you, Bill. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Open line Friday, 602-508-0960. Anything on your mind? Anything you want to ask me? I do everything but legal, medical, or accounting advice, I think. Rick is in Phoenix. Hello, Rick. Hi, Rick. Are you there, Rick?
Yes.
There
yes,
you are.
I'm here. Hello, Professor Leibson.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, Seth. Thank you.
Thank you.
I heard the beep, and then there was nothing there.
Oh, it's probably a button I pushed wrongly.
Well, I don't know. You know, it could be it could be the rush keys.
Yes, it could be.
Hey, Seth, the reason I'm calling today is because you're playing that interview that you had with Professor
Dershowitz, yeah.
Yeah. Reminded me, and I've been thinking about this for a long time, and I just haven't been able to find it, and I'm starting to think maybe it's just my faulty memory, but I seem to remember that somewhere back there, after President Trump had done something or the other, and I don't remember exactly what he did, but I seem to remember that there was someone in the intelligence community that basically made kind of a veiled threat against President Trump and said, you know, you better be careful what you say or do or something, or you're going to find out just how much power we have, or you're going to be in big trouble, or something to that effect. Is that just part of my imagination?
Oh, gosh, it does ring a faint bell, and I am struggling with it to get it exactly right. There's a faint bell being rung by it, Rick.
Yeah.
I'm thinking a little bit about when James Comey first met with Donald Trump. And was talking to him about the quote unquote dossier, and it might have come out of there. It might have come from, but gosh, I can't help you much further than that. I'd have to probably do a bit of a search on that.
Yeah, I'll keep looking. But
by the way, speaking of intelligence community, we don't really know what community this person. Do you remember the book Anonymous that came out?
Yes.
Boy, what a thud that landed with.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
That just made no mark anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. It just keeps. It just blows my mind that the Democrats and the left just keep throwing all this stuff against the wall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one thing after the other. They come when something falls flat, they just come up with something else, and then that falls flat and they come up with something else. I it seems like there ought to be a statute of limitations, or the pile of, you know what, is getting too high, cut it out or something.
Yeah, there's a big story out today, sort of a big story. The Washington Post printed a story on a meeting Donald Trump had with his Secretary of State, then Rex Tillerson, Secretary of Defense, then Jim Mattis, a couple others over at the Pentagon. And it's a story of how they were trying to do a PowerPoint presentation for him over the course of 90 minutes or 2 hours and kind of explain the world to him and how he misunderstood NATO, misunderstood our foreign relationships, and how he kind of just lost it on them in the sense of his temper. And started dressing them down. And a lot of people on Twitter, social media, other commentators are talking about this as, you know, what a disgrace to see the president acting this way towards these people. But no one stopped and asked, in the criticisms Donald Trump had of him that were reported, about how Afghanistan was being mismanaged, about how Iraq was being mismanaged, about how NATO was getting away with not paying its full dues, about the Iran nuclear deal. No one seems to be asking, but was Donald Trump right?
Yeah.
Was he right?
Exactly.
And I think what they're missing here is they're missing that I think most people, maybe they wouldn't talk the way he talked to them. Maybe they would. I don't know. He is the president, after all. He has the right to talk to his underlings the way he wants to, I suppose, within certain limits of decorum and law, but that aside, you know, don't most Americans think that something's rotten in the state of Afghanistan, something's rotten in the state of what's going on with our troop deployments in Iraq, We are kind of tired of NATO, not NATO members not paying their full share. Are we not kind of happy that we're not giving billions of dollars to the Iranian regime anymore? Money that, as John Kerry said, got into the hands of terrorists.
Yeah.
I mean, was he right? Was he right? That's the question no one's asking. Everyone wants to defend the institutions and the decorum. I think most people want him to go and shake things up and start changing some minds.
Exactly. You put your finger right on the issue. I think we want him to shake things up. And you know, the hypocrisy is just incredible, Seth, to me. When President Obama would, you know, treat people, maybe he didn't yell at them or use the language or whatever, but he treated people with such disdain and disgust and in ways that were really, you know, not very becoming or not very nice. And he got a total pass on it. I mean, you know.
The 80s are calling and want their foreign policy back.
Yeah.
He said to Mitt Romney, turns out Mitt Romney was right.
Yep.
All you have to do is ask the Democrats today. They'll tell you Russia's our biggest competitive threat, or at least geostrategic threat.
Mm-hmm.
When Republicans were talking about immigration reform, he derided us as having said, what, do they want to build a moat?
Yeah.
Yes, that kind of stuff. You didn't build
that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, let me just add one final note,
sure.
Beth. The reason that we call you professor is because of this very kind of thing. You may not call yourself professor, but we all know that you are the professor.
No.
And the reason is because of your own knowledge and experience, because of the connections that you have, a la with Alan Dershowitz and many, many others, that you bring in all of these resources. And then you have a way of pulling out of your audience just some terrific, interesting, fascinating, and important and informative information.
Well,
so
you're awfully kind to say all that, Rick. You're awfully kind to say that. All I ever wanted was all I ever really wanted to do was be a teacher, whether the classroom was at the secondary level or post. But I will tell you, I love having this seminar with y'all. I just adore it. I love learning from y'all. I love interacting with y'all. I love learning from you all every single day. But the professor thing, it's a funny. Do you know the story of Daniel Patrick Moynihan and James Buckley? I'll tell you that story when we come back. Jim Buckley was William Buckley's brother, a one-term U.S. senator from New York. I'll tell you that story when we come back. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. I am Seth. Oh, the story. Yes, Jim Buckley was a U.S. senator from New York. He was William Buckley's brother. He's still alive, I think. Had a great staff, by the way. One of the great staffs, renownedly great staffs of all time, James Buckley had. And he was running for re-election in 1976, I think it was, against Daniel Patrick Moynihan. Quoted him a lot lately, haven't I? Or at least I brought him up a lot lately. He was running for re-election. Daniel Patrick Moynihan was the Democrat, and James Buckley was asked about being challenged by this Harvard professor, and James Buckley went off on Moynihan. Well, I'm looking forward to debating the professor and seeing what the professor has to say and what the professor... Anyway, a reporter went to Daniel Patrick Moynihan for his response. He said he kept referring to you as Professor Moynihan, and Daniel Moynihan says, I see the mudslinging has already begun. I don't know that professor is the emolument, or at least the title most people would aspire to these days. It's nothing I really aspire to. I just like teaching. I like teaching, and I like being taught. I like education in both directions. And anyway, if it's used sarcastically, too bad. I remember one other thing I'll say about the word professor, I suppose. It's sometimes used colloquially among colleagues who learn a lot from each other, or at least politely try to convey that they're learning a lot from each other. I used to lunch occasionally with Christopher Hitchens, and he would call me professor, which was not, I don't think, unique to me. My guess is he would, whenever he got into a discussion or debate, it was, and that's what we often did, was debate or argue friendly. He probably calls everyone called everyone professor. What do you think, professor? What do you think, professor? But with him, it was always kind and sporting and delightful. By the way, he would have been a great professor, just a great, great teacher. It's too bad that you think about the kinds of things he stood for and other great public intellectuals stand for that we'll never see a classroom or never could see a classroom, college classroom, outside of a guest lecture because, well, because politically correct institutions like universities would never hire them. What a mistake, because what a deprivation to the students and their quest for intellectual enlightenment. Just too bad. Just really too bad. Remember one of my old professors, Charles Kessler, once said, one of the worst places to learn about the Constitution is law school. I think one of the worst places to learn anything is any college these days. Honestly, I do. Happy 98th birthday, Betty White. My gosh. Wow. I'm Seth Leibson, 602-508-0960. We'll be right back.